I would be grateful for your prayers this morning. I'd like to speak to you by the Lord's help about finding the way to the upper room. Easter season's coming. The Lord's been talking to me a little bit about that. Scripture I'd like to begin with is in the 14th chapter of the book of Mark. And I think we'll start with the 10th verse, which says, "And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. When they heard it, they were glad, and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. The first day of unleavened bread, when he killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, Well wilt thou that we go, and prepare that thou mayest eat the Passover? And he sendeth forth two of his disciples, and saith unto them, Go ye into the city, and there shall meet you a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wheresoever he shall go in, say ye to the good man of the house, The master saith, Where is the guest chamber, where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared. There make ready for us. His disciples went forth, came into the city, and found as he had said unto them. And they made ready the Passover. And in the evening he cometh with the 12. So that's Mark's version of the story. And it's also repeated with added details in Matthew's and Luke's gospel, which underlines the importance of this otherwise seemingly trivial event. It bears our study. It's worth some background. Passover was, maybe our Thanksgiving would be somewhere between 25% and half as important as the Passover was to the Jews. Thanksgiving's important time to us. Everybody likes to gather home. It's a special meal. And it has even today, it has a religious significance. It's a time of giving thanks to the Lord, originated by our pilgrim fathers. This tradition went clear back to the deliverance from Egypt, and it was the single most important day on the Jewish calendar. Everybody who could possibly do it tried to go to Jerusalem at that time. Those who couldn't had their own way of keeping the Passover. It was important to the folks. And just like our Thanksgiving, only more so, it was surrounded by rituals and practices. Thanksgiving's about the only time we ever have cranberry sauce at my house. We get pumpkin pie a little more often than that at my house. But there are just certain things. Turkey, about the only time of the year we ever have a whole turkey. Well, that's the way it was with this feast that the Jews were having. And there's a prelude to all of this that's going on. I didn't record all of it to read to you, but I need to rehearse it a little bit. Jesus and his disciples were at Bethany. It hadn't been so very long before that Lazarus was raised from the dead. It's the most remarkable story. There's only a few hints of what took place after that in the scriptures, but it's astonishing. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. He'd been dead so long, his family said, don't disturb the tomb because his body has already started to deteriorate. He came walking out. It was such a remarkable miracle just before the Passover that people were coming from Jerusalem to Bethany, distance of about 4 miles, having heard of this incredible event, to see him. And the scribes and Pharisees heard about that, and their solution was to kill Lazarus. Of all foolish things to do. As if the Lord couldn't raise him up again from the dead. You're going to kill him every Tuesday? But they had the idea somehow. Well, human means are what the devil uses to try to combat what the Lord is doing. And they didn't have any power to raise anybody from the dead or do the kind of things that Jesus was doing. So they thought in their own human way of approaching it. So there was a threat to Lazarus and by association to his sisters, Mary and Martha. And we know now that Mary and Martha prepared a feast for the Lord at Bethany just before he went up to Jerusalem for the final time. And at that feast, Two of the Gospels are a little bit vague about who it was. Somebody took an alabaster box of ointment and broke it over Jesus' feet. But one of the later Gospels, these according to the chronology in which the books were written, John was last, and one of the later ones told us who it was. It was Mary, Martha's sister. And there are other things in the Gospels that are reticent. They're not very clear about all these events that took place at Bethany. Enough to make you think that when Mark and Luke wrote their Gospels, there was still a threat. 25 years later or so, that if the scribes and Pharisees had it all pinpointed where all this took place, they might still go back and retaliate against those people. Now that's hatred, isn't it? And they had decided that Jesus had to go. So they hatched out a murder plot, gangland style, catch him off guard and, you know, stab him in a dark alley somewhere. Then Judas went to him. Now Judas had seen the alabaster box broken. Several of the apostles apparently murmured about it. Why this waste was their complaint. But the Lord reproved it. He said, justified what Mary had done, said she's done it against my burial, and so forth. And Judas was stung by that. He'd been getting disenchanted for a while, but this stung him. It pushed him over the edge. He was that strong in his contention. Following that, he went and found the chief priests and said, I'll make a deal with you. I can deliver this man into your hands. Then they're glad. Because they don't have to murder him in a dark alley. Because with him identified, they can bring a charge against him. They're afraid to do it just on whatever grounds they'd been made. Because every time they challenged Jesus about doctrine, he made them look silly. But now they've got one of his own. And their idea is surely this man will testify anything that he needs to because he already showed us that he's willing to betray the Lord. So they proceeded with this little murder plot that is mentioned here. And Jesus knew all of that, of course. You would notice if you look through Jesus' life that he never tried to shield himself from the suffering that he knew was coming. Neither did he hear. But he did say, it's really important to me to spend this time that's coming in special place with those who'd have been closest to me. And I'm glad he did. About a third of the book of John is taken up with a story of things that happened in the upper room. When I read that, I wish I could have an upper room experience too. That upper room figures pretty prominently in the story of the New Testament. It's where the folks ate the last Passover. Then, as nearly as we can tell, after Jesus came and told the folks, told his apostles, now you go and tarry at Jerusalem until you be endowed with power from on high. Presumably, they went back to that same upper room and stayed there, fasting and praying until the Spirit came down. About from the time Jesus said that until it happened, about 10 days, that's how they occupied their time. What a memorable place that would have been. What a thing, after all the crucifixion, after everything that happened, to go back to that very same place where Jesus had washed their feet and make that a dedicated place of prayer for 10 days, doing nothing but fasting and praying, getting close to each other, praying through their sorrows, expecting something from the Lord. I wouldn't mind seeing that room, would you? Jesus had all this in mind, and he also knew the peril. My story has to do with how Jesus led his apostles to be able to safely get to that upper room. He knew what Judas was up to. He knew that if the plot was sprung too soon, he wouldn't have that chance. And so he took special precautions. The disciples came to him, the scripture said, and asked him, where are we going to eat the Passover? Because that was so Jewish, it was just not reasonable that Jesus would not eat the Passover with him. And in fact, of course, that was his will. But he could have, if he'd have just said, all right, I'll tell you where it is. You fellas go there. That'd be the reasonable thing to do, wouldn't it? Look, if you said to me, where are we going to have lunch? And I said, Golden Corral. The next thing I'll probably say is, you go down Gordon Cooper till you come to Harrison, take it around to the right, and about a couple of miles up there, you'll see the sign. That's the way to do it, isn't it? Jerusalem was a city of about 200,000 people at this time. And typically, when the time of Passover came, the population just about doubled. So somewhere around 400,000 people, likely there. 200,000 people. That's the size of Boise, Idaho. Maybe. You ever been to Boise? Well, other cities I could find that are closer you might know about don't match the size. Suppose we take you to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Set you down on the edge of town and say, now, when you see a man come by with a water pot, follow him. These fellows had been to the temple, but anybody who's ever even seen pictures of those eastern cities knows that they're a labyrinth, a regular forest of small twisting streets, closely crowded together habitations. Most of them are dirty. And winding this way and that, it'd be so easy to get lost in one of those places. I'll tell you, years ago, a business associate and I were sent to Monterrey, Mexico to do some work. Flew into the airport there. He spoke Spanish. I didn't. Hired a cab. We were going to where a new mall was being constructed. It was huge. Everything in it was new. All the stores were new, and we were going to one of the biggest stores. We hired a cab. We said, here's the address. Do you know where this is? We thought everybody in Monterey would know where it is. If I would say to you, Penn Square Mall, probably everybody in the room would be able to find their way there. He said, sure, I know, get in. We put our luggage in. He took off driving down into Monterey, Mexico, and he got down in the center of town. And he said, now, it's right around the corner here. It's comparable to downtown Oklahoma City. He said, it's right around the corner. He said, I'm not going to try to drive any closer because there's too much traffic down there, but you just walk around the corner and you'll see it. So we paid him, and he put us out with our bags, and we walked around the corner, and there's no mall there. And we looked around, and he was gone. He didn't know where it was either. He just took us downtown and pushed us out. We rented another taxi and went back out to the airport and got a car of our own and wandered around half the night trying to find it. And that was a huge mall. Can you imagine if somebody would say to you, go into Oklahoma City and this is a room that I want you to go to. When a fella comes by carrying a water pot on his shoulder, follow him. Folks, the Lord's got a way of guiding us exactly where he wants us to go. But it is never the way according to human understanding. He deals with it according to what the circumstances are. You can read this and say, why did Jesus choose a roundabout way like that? Well, if you read this message that I read to you here from Luke's gospel, you'll find out that the two apostles that he chose for the job were probably two that he trusted the most. They're John and Peter. Because if Judas found out about this, he's going to do something to betray the Lord before he gets there. The idea is for the scribes and the Pharisees to be able to find Jesus when he's not in the middle of a crowd. When he's preaching and there's 1,000 people out there listening to him, it's dangerous to harm him. Catch him by himself. That's really what Judas promised to do. And so the Lord, knowing all of that, he did it this way. And you read this and say, is this a miracle? That the Lord caused, do you think that the Lord told somebody, now I'm going to send two fellows in there, so you stand around with a water pot on your shoulder till they get there. And wander around maybe for hours, and he doesn't know what they look like either. And they didn't have genetic testing then. They're just two men. They'd be my disciples. That's all the identification there could have been. And follow. So they went into the city. And sure enough, here came a man carrying a water pot. Men didn't carry water pots. Women carried the water pots on top of their head, usually. And when they did have water, they usually carried it in some other kind of container besides a clay vessel. It was very unusual for a man to be carrying a clay vessel, and that kind of work was always done in the morning. When Jesus met the woman at the well, it was unusual for her to be there in the middle of the day. And you notice it was not a man that he met there. It was a woman. That was woman's work. Men didn't do that. In our culture, when I was a boy, I can say, men didn't wash dishes as much as they do now. My mother told me, if you'll take care of the outside chores, I'll make the girls do the inside chores. And some of the time that held true. Well, this fella is carrying a water pot, just like the Lord said he would be. I wonder if he even knew that Peter and John were following him. There's nothing in the Bible that indicates that he had any reason to lead them somewhere or even knew they were following him. They just told, the Lord told him, when you see that man, he's the one. But folks, he's got a way to guide you and me to the upper room,
yes, he does.
To secret experiences with Jesus, to where he bears his secret heart to us and leads us into the mysteries of the gospel that the world can never understand.
Amen.
It's a special, sacred communication. It's not a man with a water pot every time. There's not this kind of danger around it every time. But no matter how serious the peril is, the Lord always has a way to get us where he needs to go. And so that's what he did in this case. And they followed the man there. Now, preparing the upper room was quite a chore. The Lord told these fellows, ask for the guest chamber. And he said, when you do that, he'll give you the upper room. So I invite you to think about that a little bit. As I mentioned, Passover was the single most important feast of the whole Hebrew nation. People look forward to it all year long. Very precise rituals that had to be followed for that. First thing is, the homeowner would search his house from top to bottom for any place that yeast could even possibly have been. Any vessel that had ever held yeast in it, he'd put it out of his house on that sacred day. And then there was a lamb that had to be gotten for that occasion. It had to be a perfect lamb, and then you had to take that lamb to the priests at the temple. And they would inspect the lamb and tell you that it was suitable for that. You had to kill it there in the temple and dress it and then be able to take it back to where it was. All of this was just preparation. There were bitter herbs that had to be bought, certain types of them. We won't spend time there. But they were to represent the travails and hardship that the folks underwent in the wilderness. And the room itself, the furniture, the lights that be put in the room to prepare it. The Lord told these fellows, ask this man for the guest chamber. Now, that's not as odd a request as it would be to us. Because according to the Jewish practices, since there were population, the city doubled at that time, it was a sort of an unwritten law that any vacant room that there was always given to those who came free of charge. If you found a place with nobody in it, you had the right to tell the homeowner, we'd like to have this room for our celebration of the Passover. And it was just a practice that they'd give it to you. But the Lord told his apostles, ask for the guest chamber. In those houses, the guest chamber was typically like a little one bedroom you would expect, a smaller room. But he, rather than do that, usually two or three story houses in the nicer areas, led them up to the upper room, which was much larger than the guest chamber. Obviously, the place where he had intended to have the Passover with his own family. Now, you brethren, try that with your wife. When Thanksgiving comes and she's got the turkey ready and the mashed potatoes and the gravy and the cranberry sauce and got it out there on the table and the lamb or meat or whatever it is that you're having, walk up and say, well, you know, we got these visitors that are coming, so we're not going to eat there, and see how that works. But you know, I think in the years that followed, whoever this was very, very thankful that he did what these fellows came and asked him to do. I think the Lord put it on his heart. And I remind you of this, brethren, you can't outgive the Lord. Sometimes it's hardship. Sometimes it's unpleasant. and it's at disadvantage, and it goes against the plans that we have made. It'd be easy for that man's children and family to say, but Dad, we've been preparing for this for months. This is the high day of our whole year. It's so important to us. The Lord, at the very same time that he was a beggar, he was also a king. He sent this message. You go beg for the room, beg for the lowest room, but you tell him the master has need of it. Oh, brother, that word is reason enough for us to turn loose of anything we've got. When we get a message from the heaven that the master has need of it, he is to us as he was there, very poor in some ways. He'll take the widow's mites. He'll take the alabaster box of ointment. But brother, you put it in the Lord's hands. You'll never regret it. You'll never regret it. This is one of the sweetest, most beautiful scenes in the Bible. The lessons taught in the upper room contain the very vivid beating heart of Christianity. They have been comforting to millions of people in all the generations since. Who knows what little sacrifice you and I make, seemingly small, put it in the Lord's hands, how he may magnify it and cause it to reach far beyond anything that we understood. Look at it the other way. What if this fellow had said no? I don't know whether Jesus made prior arrangement with this man or not. The Bible doesn't say. But if he hadn't, even if he had, what a sacrifice it was. And what if he'd have said no? No, this is for my family. This is a very sacred religious event for us, and we're going to keep it to the Lord. So on the other hand, we're going to keep the Lord out and not allow him to come in to this that we're supposedly celebrating in his name. People have done that. People have done that with things the Lord called on them to do. In a way, the rich young ruler did that. He came to the Lord and said, I've lived in my language. I've lived my whole life for this moment. Now, what more can I do to you? And he was ideally prepared to be another Paul. He'd been trained. He had the background. He had the holy life to all that the law required. But the Lord couldn't give it to him because he had too much money in his hands. And all he needed to do was turn loose of it, and perhaps he could have been Silvanus to Paul, Silas, and gone with him. But instead, his money got in his way. This man could have probably done that same thing. This anonymous Christian, whoever he was, there's another lesson in this. Folks, not everybody who worships in our chapel is a child of God. I need to say that another way. There are people who will be in heaven that you and I never met in this world. Jesus has disciples that we know nothing about. We search one another with our eyes and with our hearts as best we can and have our human understanding. But the Lord looks down on people in their secret bedchambers and knows all there is to know about them. He knows who he can speak to, who he can trust. And so the plan unfolded just like the Lord wanted it to. For whatever reason, that man went out in the middle of the day to get some water, doing woman's work. Instead of carrying it in a leather bag, he put it in a clay vessel and carried it however he was carrying it. And just at the right time, here came the two that the Lord sent. And they led him right to the place. Don't even know the man even knew they were following him. Led him right to the place where the Lord wanted him to go. Never read where he said a word to that man. But they said to the owner of the place, can we have the guest room, the master has need of us. And folks, if you live for the Lord, you have a lot of experiences just like that along the way. Anonymous people, could I say, mean a lot to the plan of salvation. It isn't important to get your name recognized in front of folks. It's important to follow the voice of the Lord. And so they did in this case. Now I want to encourage you, my friends and my brethren, that's been a long time ago. But the Lord still has a way to guide us into where he wants us to go.
Yes,
he's still got people carrying water pots on their shoulders when he tells them to do it. And in the end, these people were able to find the room that was suited to their occasion. The Lord entertained his 12 apostles in that room. Whoever owned the house did not interfere with them and what they were doing. Presumably they were eating their own Passover somewhere else in the same building, but they didn't have any interaction with what he had, the private time that he was looking for. He chose the weak things of this earth to confound the mighty. You can't prove this for sure, but the early fathers have a tradition that this man was John Mark's father. If I'm not mistaken, that's the same man that went with Paul on one of his missionary trips, his son. And it's the same man when Peter got delivered from jail. That's where he found the apostles gathered together praying. The Bible doesn't say very much about that either, and maybe for the same reasons, because if it was known, everything, they might have gotten persecuted for what they were doing. Isn't there a lesson in that? I want to say it this way. Recently at the minister's meeting in Guthrie, the folks got in a conversation about ordination, and I'll refer to it just briefly. Ordination, in my mind, is naming animals. It's naming animals. The Lord made the animals. Man didn't have anything to do with it. The genetic code that's in each one, the nature that they have, the way they live. Some live in trees. Some live under the ground. Some live in the ocean. No man ever created any of those things. Man really had no part in it. But God, in his love and in his wisdom, he wants to include humans in everything that he does. He gives us a part. It's not a big part. He made them, then he brought them back past Adam, and he said, what are they? You get to name them. And I see Adam looking at it and say, well, look at that funny looking thing. It's got two horns on the front of it, and instead of being on the sides like a cow, they're on top of each other. And that is one ugly looking beast. That couldn't be anything but a rhinoceros, and so a rhinoceros it is. And look at that funny one down there in the water, wagging his tail and eating everything he gets close to. That is a crocodile. Look at those big old teeth. He didn't make a tooth. He just named them. But the Lord wanted to share it with him. There's no other reason for God to do that. The Lord makes a minister. He teaches them. He gives them the training, the background, the understanding. He gives them the anointing. He leads them through every step. We don't do any of that. He just lets us have a part in it of recognizing that's what he's done. And so we say, well, God's done this. He wants us to have a share in it. We get to put our approval on it too. We didn't make him at all, but we ordain him because he's down here working with us, and the Lord wants us to have a share in it. Well, the Lord did something like that here. These apostles didn't do any of these things by themselves. They just followed the man with the water pot and helped with the preparations in the room. The Lord knew the enemy was about to get him. He knew what they were plotting to do. He knew it was going to happen. He was brave. He did not do one thing to prevent that happening. In fact, his controlling hand made him offer his own sacrifice. It could never have been done if he hadn't voluntarily done it. But he wanted us to have a part in it too. Our job is to get to follow the man with the water pot. The Lord has a way of taking care of the rest of us. Then when we get there, we get to help set up the room. And then the Lord comes in and delivers the message that resonates through all eternity. Isn't that really a picture of what the church is? Yes, it is? He guides us where he wants us to go. He fills us with the light and understanding that he wants us to have in his mercy. He imparts his blessing to us. And our part is just to follow where he leads us. Just pretty much follow your nose. Keep him in sight. You know, you can tell he's a man. He's doing something men don't do. He's the one with a pot on his shoulder. That's your job. That's the way it is in serving the Lord. The devil makes it look hard, fearsome. It's not. It's just a simple way of walking with Jesus. That's my message for this morning. Thank you for the courtesy of your attention. Amen.